Hey, it's Darren Johnson, Weekly Newspaper Podcast. This microphone only has 41 minutes of recording time left on it, and the battery is down to one notch, so I don't know how long I can go, maybe 20 minutes, 25 minutes, lucky you, you don't have to listen to me bloviate for too long. I think the topic today is going to be on advertising. In this world of small newspapers, this is the Weekly Newspaper Podcast, we hear about, you know, all these models for sustaining your newspaper. There are, like, maybe you'll get government funding, maybe you could file for not-for-profit status and get, you know, a board of directors and get donations. Maybe, you know, you will get subscribers, and subscribers will all flock and subscribe to your paper and pay you $10 a month each or something, and you'll be on Easy Street. The oldest, though, method for funding newspapers, and mostly print, I would guess, because the online world hasn't adapted, as there's just too many options online, so it's so diluted that you only make pennies on the dollar with this, and it is advertising. Advertising is the way that papers, probably for all of the 1900s, made most of their money. You know, they would make some money off of newsstand, sell it for a penny or two, or, you know, whatever, nickel, dime, quarter. They would make some money off of newsstand, but they made the majority of their money off of advertising. And that still exists with a lot of, especially print papers today, that's still their primary business model. Now, in the world of journalism, there's debate. Should, you know, how far should it go? Should advertising influence where a newspaper goes? Is this the best model ethically for a newspaper? Now, you can debate all the different aspects of how you get funded. If you're going the donation model, if some, you know, rich person gives you $500,000 or whatever, $50,000, $500, whatever model your paper is that worse or better than having an ad from some faceless corporation like McDonald's or some car dealership buy your back cover and put a bunch of things for sale in the ad? Like, I would think having a big donation would be more problematic than having some random ad in your paper that is a topic you normally don't really cover anyway editorially. So instead of having someone who's the local Democrat or Republican donate a bunch of money and expect a certain type of coverage, or they're rewarding your past coverage that they feel is favorable to their worldview, instead you just have some faceless company buy an ad. McDonald's, hey, Big Macs are on sale. And as a newspaper, you don't cover Big Macs or McDonald's or restaurants even that much anyway. So you're getting money. They're selling more Big Macs. You could just go on covering your school board, covering your town board, covering the sports league. And the two, you know, shall never intertwine. They'll never conflict with each other. And then, of course, it gets a little hairy around ads that are political in nature. You might get an ad, you know, around political time, and the public increasingly doesn't understand ads. But you could, you know, they might think, like, oh, you got a bunch of Republican ads in your paper. You're a Republican newspaper or a Democratic paper or whatever. And they don't understand that, no, you know, you have a rate card, and the Republicans or the Democrats or both or neither came up with some money, and they paid the prevailing rate. It was fair. You didn't give them any discounts. You charged the same for Republicans and Democrats. One party took you up on your offer, the other didn't. That doesn't mean you are a paper of that party. But in the minds of readers, sometimes they think, okay, I see a bunch of ads for a party I don't like. This paper must not be for me. And so it gets a little problematic in that regard, but that's more in that they don't understand how advertising works, because it's become decreasingly common in media outlets. So when they do see ads, they don't understand how they work. So a newspaper, I think, has to have some responsibility to explain, maybe through editorials that or house ads, that that anyone can advertise in this paper within reason. You know, an established political party can advertise in a paper. You know, now if it were the Nazi party came to town, you know, and they're not going to get more than 1% of the vote anyway, can you refuse that ad? You probably could refuse that ad. But if it's, you know, a mainstream organization, that it's fair game. They can buy an ad. But it's become increasingly problematic. I had I recently rewatched Breaking Bad, the TV series, for probably like the 5th or 6th or 7th, or I don't want to know how many times, because I put it on as background, and I've seen it so many times now that it's, I always see something new when I put it on, because it's such a meticulous and full show. There's so much in it. Every scene is well planned out. And so I notice new things in it all the time. And it's probably, I'd say it's in my top three shows. Because it's on Netflix and I pay for Netflix, I can just put it on and it can just keep running. But, you know, other shows I kind of like are Sopranos. I think that's a really good show, too. It's on Max, HBO Max, and I can, I guess, run that, too, in sequences, but I have, like, one of the lesser Max subscriptions that puts, you know, unironically ads into HBO, and Netflix, I pay for the ad-free version, so I'll watch Breaking Bad on ad-free as opposed to Sopranos with ads, I guess. But sometimes I'll cycle through Sopranos, too. And then, you know, I'd say maybe number three, since I mentioned top three, I think maybe I'd put Better Call Saul in there. Better Call Saul is a spin-off of, it's a spin-off prequel of Breaking Bad. In any case, Breaking Bad, there's a concept in Breaking Bad. And when an entity breaks this concept, when they go outside the realm of the concept, it usually causes some kind of strife. So the concept is in the game. Are you in the game? So the people who are making the meth in Breaking Bad, the ones who distribute it, the ones in the various cartels, the ones who are street dealers, the ones who work as henchmen. And one thing I had never really understood in these shows is, who'd want to be a henchman? Like, they always have these henchmen out to be like these super, like these superheroes who work for the cartel. They almost always get killed in whatever show it is. If someone's a henchman, they're probably going to get killed. So how much do you have to pay a henchman? You'd probably have to pay them a lot of money to be a henchman. And, you know, I know they probably don't have great resumes. They probably, like, you know, don't pass background checks. If they're going to apply for a job at, like, Target or Walmart, they probably wouldn't pass the background check. But, like, still, you know, as opposed to them being lone wolves and going out there and robbing banks, and you're corralling them to be a henchman for your organization. You know, you do want them to be reliable, so you probably have to pay them, like, I would think, $200,000 a year to be like a cartel, you know, let's say north of the border henchman for like Gus Fring or something like that. I would think the pay would have to be $200,000 at least, like cash, for that to work out, to be a henchman. In any case, they have this concept called in the game. And in the game means, like, if you are in this realm, you are somehow related, even if you're the lawyer for the cartel or something. You're, now, you know, the lawyer might have some more protections and such. If you're a corrupt cop and you're dealing with these people, whatever it is, you're in the game. So you're playing the game. So the game is, hey, we have this company, it makes illegal drugs and distributes them, and anyone connected, even dotted line, is in the game. Newspapers aren't selling meth, but they're addictive in their own way. And on Breaking Bad, if someone, or, you know, Better Call Saul, the spinoff, or even Sopranos, although to a lesser degree, because they seem a little bit, they seem a little bit more more feral, I think, on Sopranos. But if someone isn't in the game, like, let's say they're just in, I think it was Better Call Saul, but maybe it was, yeah, it was Better Call Saul. There was one faction was hitting the drug transportation truck of another faction, and they blew out its tires and stole its merchandise and left the driver tied up on the side of the road. And a civilian, as they're sometimes called, someone who was nothing, who was not in the game, just a good Samaritan, was driving by afterward and found this tied up driver. And said, "Oh, you know, I better do something about this," and helped the driver get out of his quagmire. But because of, you know, like, this was a real fishy situation, they killed the Good Samaritan, and that didn't sit right with one of the people in Breaking Bad. One of the, you know, he had a moral code. He was one of the henchmen too, you know. He thought, like, hey, that guy, you know, that passerby was not in the game and didn't deserve to be killed. Like, we have to have some honor code and protect the people that are not in this game, or at least, like, exclude them in some way. So you don't have that collateral damage of killing people or hurting people or involving people even who aren't in the game, who don't make that decision. And Better Call Saul, the spinoff, is, it kind of shows, like, this, you know, low-level attorney, someone who went to, you know, the worst law school and barely passed the bar and that type of thing. And he's in a, you know, he's not in New York or California, he's out in New Mexico, so it's not even a state where it's probably hard to pass the bar. And he becomes part of the game, you know, his moral compunction is to maybe bend the rules, and he becomes part of this game. So there's the in the game concept. I think this in the game concept applies to advertising, and I know this is a with newspapers anyway. And I know this is a bone of contention, and probably less so as time goes by, in the world of journalism. In journalism education, the colleges. I think the old school rationale was, when newspapers were flush with money and making tons of money, so 1900s, that there should be a strict wall between advertising and editorial in the newspaper, especially at a big newspaper, but there should be a strict wall between the two. Because you don't want your journalists to get influenced by the advertising. You know, if Joe Car Dealer buys a bunch of ads, and then Joe Car Dealer is also doing a Ponzi scheme, and should local reporters, you know, they might, because of his largesse, the local reporters might say, oh, maybe we won't advertise Joe the Car Dealer. Or we won't not advertise. We won't report on Joe the Car Dealer's legal woes or we'll go soft on him because he's a generous advertiser. You know, that's an extreme example. You know, in reality, the advertisers are the advertisers, and the stuff you report on really isn't all that related to business and such. Like, you probably wouldn't report on if the local restaurant, you know, they got some dings on their health inspection. Now, back in the day, maybe you would. Maybe back in the day when newspapers were just so, you know, they were so full and they just had so many, they had so much money coming in and, you know, they could afford to have people covering, like, restaurant board of health reviews. You know, I remember seeing those briefly in some daily paper in the last century or something. But newspapers don't have that kind of personnel today to do that kind of reporting. Like, hey, how did the local restaurant score on their board of health review? That's just not something that they can do anymore. And there's so many other venues that could do that. There's, like, just the basic internet where you can search and see what the board of health says about your local restaurant. But there's also, like, Google reviews and all these different review sites that review restaurants, and they can tell you if a restaurant is dirty or something. So you don't really need a reporter on that. So, you know, I really think, like, that wall, that divide is overstated. Now, you look at the whole history of newspapers. Early 1900s, ads were in the newspaper, but they weren't, I don't think they had gotten up to the point yet where they were the majority of revenue for a newspaper. Or maybe they were the types of ads that were just like these little nickel and dime type ads, like help wanted ads or for sale ads. You know, the newspaper would make $5 here, $5 there. It wasn't enough to influence the newspaper in any way. It didn't get to the point where big companies were buying full page $10,000 ads. You know, it hadn't gotten to that point yet. So early 1900s had that aspect. Newspapers also went editorially from being staffed by, you know, stunt journalists and people that, you know, were more writerly and independent, not college educated. And it went to formalizing things and coming up with an objective style by the early to mid 1900s as advertising revved up. And took on an objective style, and journalists became a college major. By the end of the century, the majority of journalists had college education, and if not direct journalism education that they had gotten at a college, and a whole bunch of standards and practices in editorial and being objective had been developed. So, and also advertising ramped up by the mid to, you know, late 1900s, newspapers were making 80-90% of their revenue off of advertising. Now it's probably back down to, at best, 50% at, like, the most successful newspapers. Maybe they make half their income off of traditional advertising. So that's even hopeful for a lot of papers. And they're, you know, the ads aren't what they were since the beginning of this century, because of the internet for the most part. In any case, you know, like I said, this battery and this microphone could go at any time. In any case, this separation in the newsroom happened over the 1900s, where advertising was on one end, editorial was on the other end, and they didn't meet. Now, if you think about it from the publisher's point of view, what else happened in the 1900s? Newspapers consolidated and were bought up by corporations and chains. So, and they became less independent. So there were very few of these newspapers, like the one I own in upstate New York, where, and, you know, there still are if they're real tiny newspapers like the one I own. You know, they lost their independence. Okay, so the mom and pop idea of a newspaper, you know, it's kind of, you know, where, now, in small town level, it still existed, but at anything more than the small town level, almost every newspaper was owned by a corporation, and even the corporations bought some small town newspapers. So they consolidated in the hands of six, seven, eight national chains, and then some regional chains. And the newspapers, you know, they kind of conspired to change their style. They, you know, the Joseph Pulitzers and William Randolph Hearsts of the world, they said, hey, you know, in the early 1900s, we have these over-the-top newspapers. They're veering into yellow journalism, but they're also providing some exciting journalism that people want to read. Maybe we could come up with a third-person objective style, AP style, you know, Chicago style, some kind of style that is objective, or it compartmentalizes our journalists. We can train them. They could all get the same training. They could all learn the same principles, and they'll be more uniform. Some might say, you know, more bland, but we'll have a style of writing that can be taught and can be moved from newspaper to newspaper. You could use it across the whole country as a part of your chain, and it's kind of almost like a non-compete clause, because now all of the newspapers are doing the same style of journalism, and people are taking it. It's the Mick journalism, you know, that USA Today is, of you give it, you deliver it in a certain style, it's fine. Might even maybe occasionally win like an award of some sort, Pulitzer Prize or something. It's fine, and it does the job. It fills the newspaper. The newspaper has a lot of ads too, so you have to fill the newspaper. You can't let these journalists go. But it also made it, by separating the duties at a newspaper, it also made it near impossible for journalists to go off and start their own newspapers, because they didn't understand all the different facets of making a newspaper, because they were now compartmentalized. So all they had to do was write, for example, or edit, or take photos, or on the business end, someone would just sell ads, but they didn't understand the editorial end. The graphic designers didn't understand, you know, the editorial end. So everything was compartmentalized at these papers, and that made it impossible practically for someone to just say, hey, I've worked at this newspaper for 5-10 years, I think I'll go off and start my own newspaper. It became really hard to do that, because how do you compete with these big corporations and everything they have in place, and how do you put together a newspaper? Now, one of the pluses, you know, everyone's always down on print newspapers, but one of the pluses of the 21st century is, while newspapers have seen a big decrease in advertising and newsrooms have shrunk thereby because there's not as much money coming in, it probably is easier than ever before if someone is so motivated to start a print newspaper and do a little bit of everything, like go around and ask people if they'd like advertising. Now, someone like me will never be as good, from an editorial background, will never be as good at selling ads as someone who, you know, drives like a Mazda Miata and has a gym membership and they, you know, they have a gold necklace, and I will never be as good an ad salesman. They know what brand of shoes to buy. I'll never be as good an ad salesman as those people of lore. And those people of lore, that personality type, they've moved on to other things. They're not selling print advertising anymore because they can make more money selling other things. So you can't even find that person anymore that probably, you know, wears the pinky ring and could sell Joe's Pizza Place on a 12-month plan to really help them, you know, help them grow to the next level and via advertising in a print newspaper. You can't find those people anymore. But whatever the case, someone like me can have a bunch of different skills. I tend to think, like, while I'm not the best at selling ads, I can be passable at selling ads. I can say, hey, we have this publication. It's authentic. It reaches a real audience. They like it. People who do advertise in it report success. I'll give you a good rate because I'm the person in charge. I don't get a commission, so I could charge less for the ad. And hey, you know, let's make a deal. I'm a grown adult. As a grown adult, you make business decisions in your life all the time and haggle for your car, your house. You know, you decide if you want a metal roof or a shingled roof. You know, you make these decisions all the time. And so selling advertising is just like being an adult and saying to local businesses that might advertise, hey, consider this. Now, I'll never be as like cutthroat and heartless and, you know, and to the point. I don't think heartless is the word. Maybe like not having your heart in it. You know, like if you're just an ad salesperson, you can have that clarity of thought because you don't have to worry about the editorial concerns and you can just sell people on these long-term plans. But at the very least, I can keep an enterprise going. I know if things are becoming tough and I have a printer bill to pay and I'm falling behind, maybe I'll go out and sell a couple more ads. You know, maybe I'll turn off the keyboard for a little bit and you know, become extroverted me and sell a couple of ads. But there's, you know, that in the game. So to get back to the in the game aspect, when you have a small paper and you have advertising and it helps pay your bills, how much generosity should you give the advertisers outside of the fact that you are giving them ads in your paper? You're not giving the ads, they're paying for the ads, but you're giving them space in your paper. You might bump them up from like an even page to an odd page or something, or move their ad up front in the paper or something like that. Odd pages, in case you don't know, are the better placement for an ad than an even page, because people are mostly right-handed and they read left to right. So an ad on the right-hand side of the page, the odd-numbered pages, are work better. But, you know, I might upgrade the advertiser, move them to the inside cover or back cover or something, or you know, those things you might do. But when it comes to the relationship with the newspaper as a whole, the newspaper is in the game. It's reporting things in town. It knows the mayors. It knows the school board presidents. It knows the person who runs the church. It knows, you know, all the different people, the Chamber of Commerce and the, you know, whoever's running a festival or the police or whoever. The newspaper's in the game. It's in it. Now, are advertisers in the game? Are they now, because they buy ads in your paper as opposed to, there's like these free papers that are totally awful. They have like no real editorial content, but they steal all the ads. You know, as opposed to buying in a paper that isn't in the game, some free crap paper, they buy in your paper that is in the game, that's reporting on the mayor's race and reporting on the school board budget and things like that. Are they now in the game? Are they a part? Are they like saying, hey, you have some mojo going on. You are a local tastemaker, this newspaper. You're an influencer. We want to be a part of that influence. We want to be a part of that sphere of influence. So now are they part of the game? And as a publisher, do you know, like, this car dealership is in the game, but this car dealership isn't in the game? And if you, so when does this come up in editorial that you might, you know, have to include someone in it? So I recently wrote a story about an event that's happening in our neck of the woods. It's the first time inaugural event. And it's for a not-for-profit. It's for a good cause. I don't want to go too deep into it because the people will be able to figure out what it is if the advertiser will be able to, or the non-advertiser in this case, will be able to figure out who it is. So they're holding an event. It seems nice. I interviewed the people organizing the event, wrote an article, mentioned where the event's going to be. The event's on a private property, and I just gave a mere mention to the private property. Now, it's a private property that is a venue that advertises in other publications, but they don't advertise in my publication. So, you know, they'll advertise in these free crap publications who happen to have the salespeople who wear the pinky ring, but they won't, they don't see it as important enough to join join our team to be in the game. So, you know, they just got a mere mention. I didn't really think about it. I just said, oh, yeah, this nice event is happening at, you know, XYZ. And, you know, it's happening on this date. And that's it. And so I get, like, a long email after the story publishes from the owner of XYZ. And the owner of XYZ says, you know, did you know that we're, like, donating the space and we, like, made the website and we... are the ones, like, you know, doing the publicity for this event, and, you know, did the people that you interviewed, did they tell you this? And I was like, yeah, you know, they kind of mentioned that you were generous, but the story really wasn't about that, it was about this event, you know, so I just mentioned, you know, mere mention, and, you know, and I also said, like, we normally don't give much play to for-profit businesses, you know, especially if they're a non-advertiser. Now, should I have added that caveat, like, especially if they're a non-advertiser? It's one of those areas. Now, I don't see it as, I don't see it as a big ethical issue. It's not like we cover these venues. But if it is an advertiser who has shown support for your publication, and it does come up in the editorial that they are mentioned in the editorial, you know, would, if it was someone I knew, if it was someone, hey, they advertise in the paper and they're holding it at their venue, would I have contacted them and gotten a quote maybe? Yeah, maybe, you know, maybe because I would have had this, they would have been in my universe. They would have been on my mind because they are an advertiser. It's not a quid pro quo. It's just that I see their ads in the paper. They're obviously friendly. They've put out an olive branch. They're in my mind. It's like, oh, okay, this advertiser advertises in our paper. It's not that I want to placate them, but it's that they happen to be a supporter. I think the readers all understand this concept. Of, like, these are people that are in our universe. They are a part of our universe because they buy an ad in the paper every issue. And, oh, okay, I'm interviewing someone who mentions that they're holding their event at this place. I know the owner. They're, you know, nice enough. Maybe I'll also send a quick email to the owner. Say, hey, I heard that you're sponsoring this event. You know, do you have anything you want to add to it? And they might not. You know, they might say, oh, yeah, you know, we're happy to be the prime sponsor of this event and to donate, you know, the food or whatever they're doing. And so is that an ethical issue of the advertiser would get slightly better coverage in an article that mentions a venue than the non-advertiser? Or is that just reality? Or is it just like some kind of spiritual consciousness of this person advertises in the paper, therefore they exist? They are a part of the storyline of this newspaper. Thus, maybe readers want to know more because they see this ad all the time. And it's like, oh, I want to know a little bit more about that business. You're not really doing them a favor, per se. It's not a quid pro quo. It's not really corrupting your story because you're doing a story about some new event that's happening at a venue, and you just happen to get an extra quote from the venue. But they're part of the universe, whereas this non-advertiser, out of sight, out of mind, why would I give them another paragraph or two in the article? They don't believe in our paper. They don't like our paper, I guess. I would take it because they don't advertise. They don't see the value in civic involvement. Also, our readers don't know this business exists because they don't advertise. So it's not news to our readers because they're not a part of our universe. So I don't really see it as an ethical issue at all if an advertiser gets some... gets a few more words in the editorial than a non-advertiser, it's because that advertiser is a known entity to the readers. So I think that's an area that where the dividing line of the last century between advertising and editorial is wrong. Now, at a daily paper, why would someone who's just a salaried employee care about this? But at a small paper where every dollar counts and the businesses are a part of the community, and there aren't so many businesses that you can just scorn, them. You can just burn them to the ground by doing like negative restaurant reviews or whatever. It's a different ballgame. You have to bump into these people on the street. But it's the in the game theory. They're in the game. It's not corrupt. It's like, it's not going to affect your coverage of government. It's just that if things pop up, you put them in there. Sometimes the for-profit businesses send us press releases. And most of the time, I just throw them away. If it's an advertiser, though, I'll at least look and see what's going, see what it is. And there is a lot of discretionary space in a newspaper. There is, let's say you're 40, you have to go in increments of 4 usually, or 8 at the printer. Let's say you have 37 pages of content that you already, it's ads and editorial, it's already written, already laid out. But you can't publish a 37-page paper. You have to publish a 40-page paper or a 36-page paper. You have to go in increments of 4. So either you cut editorial or you come up with 3 pages. The 3 pages could be a house ad, or you can go into your press releases and start to pick some of those press releases that didn't make it into the 37 pages you already laid out. So you start to say, okay, who are some of the trusted press release writers? And usually they come from not-for-profits, the not-for-profits in the area. Like, there's a local community college in our area that writes pretty good press releases. I'll say, okay, I have a half a page. I know they must have sent me a press release in the past week that would fit this little half page, or I could cut it to fit this little half page. And they're like, trusted, a trusted purveyor of press releases that I could put in. Well, sometimes I might delve into the for-profit press releases. There aren't a lot of them. Most for-profits just think in the advertising realm. They don't think in the PR realm. But every now and then they'll send something that is, hey, we hired a new a realtor at our company or something like that. So I might, it's kind of newsy. People might know that new realtor, put his picture, her picture in the paper, and say, Jill Smith was hired by XYZ Realty, and put that in there, and people might know Jill Smith. And if XYZ Realty is an advertiser, even better. So sometimes those things might get in. I'm just saying that overall, it's okay for a publisher to say, we are a newspaper, we are a part of the community, the advertisers want to be in our orbit, they want to be also known to the people that trust our newspaper because we cover this community, they are our friends. Now, it doesn't mean that, if the owner of the company is indicted for something, and you normally cover those type stories, you don't ignore it. Or you don't, and you don't run their over-the-top press releases about like, hey, the, Ford Bronco is on sale, get $2,000 cash back. You don't run those type press releases. But, if it's a names in the news type thing, you might put that in there. So, yes, you have to have your own, like the characters in Breaking Bad. Even though they're doing, they're getting their hands dirty, you do have to have some kind of code that you come up with and you abide by. And sometimes people will get mad if you say, hey, I'm not going to run your press release because you should buy an ad instead. This is more of an ad than a press release. Sorry. But I don't think people that don't like your paper and they happen to own local newspapers, they happen to own local businesses, I don't think they should be rewarded when they're giving their money to the free paper that is, killing your business model or they're advertising on Facebook, or they're advertising on billboards, screw them. You know, screw them. If they don't believe in your paper, if they have some kind of issue, you know, maybe because you are getting your hands dirty and you're writing about Republicans and Democrats, and maybe they feel strongly ideologically about something, thus why they're a small business owner, then screw them. It's their problem. If they don't want to be in our universe, if they don't want to play our game, good luck with your business. You know, we'll see who lasts longer. So that is that. This was Weekly Newspaper Podcast. I know this card's about to run out, and the battery somehow lasted. So my name's Darren Johnson. You can find more of these on weeklynewspaperpodcast.com.